Hi, everybody, and welcome to Telich Talks. So glad you're with me today, and I think you're going to really enjoy my conversation with today's guest. It is George Veras. He is a 10-time National Sports Emmy Award-winning writer, producer, and director of television live events and documentaries. George began his career way back in the day at CBS Sports, producing the iconic NFL Today pregame show on CBS. He also was involved in pregame shows for the NBA on CBS, Major League Baseball, two Pan Am Games, two Winter Olympics. He produced three other Olympics for NBC, including the first HD telecasts of the Athens Games in 2004. He has been behind the scenes and a driving force in the production of so many iconic things on various levels. Worked for the Cleveland Browns, the New Jersey Hall of Fame, the Pro Football Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and so much more, including Yanni live at the Acropolis. He's the president and the chief operating officer of Veras Communications Incorporated, and he's been part of the legendary Pollock Film Company. So much on this guy's resume. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Here on Telich Talks is Mr. George Veras. George, what a treat it is to have you on, and your resume is absolutely so spectacular. All the things that you have done in sports and business world, various halls of fames and what have you. Let me go back to the 15-year-old ball boy for the New York Jets.
I figured you'd do that.
and Joe Willie Namath was the quarterback coming in from Alabama. Your uncle was a physician, a doctor, invented the first knee brace. What a way to start off the podcast. But what was it like as a kid being the ball boy for Joe Willie Namath?
It was really incredible. And my uncle was Dr. James A. Nicholas. And I'll tell you an interesting story about him. He was really stays in my memory strong almost every other day. He had such a passion for this thing. He was the team physician for the New York Titans at first with no money. And so I actually got to go to the Polo Grounds. And the irony of the fact that Sammy Ball was the coach and there were two other Hall of Famers in that locker room. There was no Hall of Fame class yet. You're talking about 1961. Sure. The Hall of Fame hadn't started until 1963. Clyde Bulldog Turner was the coach in that locker room. So here I am. And then, as you know, 50 years later, I am servicing those Hall of Famers. So that's number one. Number two is that when, you know, Sonny took over the Jets, my uncle operated on Joe's knee, and had not been for the surgery, and Joe to this day will tell you, he would never have played. He never got treated at Alabama. You probably remember, hurt his knee. Is a rollout quarterback, like Lou Holtz tried to make him when he was with the Jets, and he hurt his knee and meniscus and ligament, and never got it surgery. People just tape those things up and you play on.
Yeah.
So, you know, he and Joe had a unique relationship. And when I walked on that field the first day, I thought I died and went to heaven.
Oh my God!
I mean, I could tell you the entire roster. Straight across the board today, Al Atkinson, 62, outside linebacker from Penn State. Larry Grantham, 1960, linebacker from Mississippi. Al Atkinson, Villanova. Those are the three linebackers. And
oh my gosh.
Forget the offense, you know, with Emerson Boozer, Sherm Plunkett, Winston Hill, Verlon Biggs, Paul Rocky Rochester, Randy Beverly, Jim Hudson, 22. I mean, I'm on the field today. I'm talking to you that way. And that's how it impacted me. And it was such a special thing that, again, nobody would think of it then. The AFL was dirt. No money, disgrace. When I came back to Shaker, because, you know, I went to Shaker Heights High School. When I was doing these summers and I wore my Jet jersey, people beat me up.
Really?
Yeah. You're in Brown City. What are you doing wearing a Jet jersey?
But you had your allegiance. I get it.
I had my allegiance. And the other thing is, I didn't come to Shaker till fifth grade. I lived in Detroit and Ann Arbor. So I was already more of a Lions fan than I ever was a Browns fan. And again, odd life of ironies. As you know, I ended up working for the Browns for 3 years, which was just unbelievable. But then the other part of the story to wrap this up for you is that I was so in love with this that when I came back to high school and we were asked to write our essay of what you did this summer, I wrote mine in green ink.
For the Jets.
For the
gosh.
Jets. And it was just like in Christmas Story with Ralphie. I thought I wrote the greatest thing ever, like that would be like AAA. But my English teacher, of course, was somebody who was probably in her 60s with white hair. And I got a C minus. Not well done. I don't get half of what you wrote about, you know.
Well, you know, nowadays, George, your parents would be in the face of the teacher saying, well, how come you gave my kid such a lousy score? He deserves more. But that was a different era, for sure.
One more, if I can, to cap this off, is that when I was being interviewed for the first job I had at the Hall as president of the Pro Football Hall of Fame Enterprise, which is the for-profit arm, I came to visit Steve Perry. I'd never met Steve Perry. Okay. Now, I knew Joe Horrigan because he and I were actually ball boys together at the same time he was with the Bills. So he and I met when the Bills and Jets played in Allentown because we had to divide up the Gatorade and the oranges. So I met Joe Horrigan when I was 16 years old.
That's right. While you're doing your duties, is that in the summer?
But when I was producing for CBS, I brought the All Madden team to host their 1987 All Madden team at the Hall of Fame. I knew how special the Hall was. In 2002, when I produced the documentary for NFL Films, Titan the Spiral, the premiere was Steve Sable was in the Hall of Fame theater.
Oh, my God.
So I was working with Joe Horrigan. So now I'm coming back. I'm walking the halls. It's 2009. He says, I got to show you this. And we go to the Super Bowl III gallery. He has my uncle's knee brace in the gallery.
Oh, my gosh.
It's in the gallery. The first
doggone knee brace. Yeah. We take that for granted, George. We look at games today, and they were talking on the one of the games yesterday about – you know, the brace that Kincaid, the tight ends, was wearing, and, you know, how it's developed from, you know,
today,
and, you know, how he's on the sidelines getting it. So that's spectacular.
So anyway, that all, if I don't walk on the field as a ball boy of the Jets, none of that happens.
I kind of figured that was why I wanted to start with the,
well, thank
with
you
the,
for that.
With the Broadway Joe thing. So let's leap forward just a bit from that to CBS Sports 1981. You start as an AP. Associate producer, but then you are at the forefront of how that show, really the first one of its kind. What was it like in those days with the stars that, and who came, why did someone decide there was a need to have a preamble to a game? Because I don't think a lot of people were thinking on those terms back then.
Well, this was the brilliance of a programmer named Bob Wessler.
Okay.
And actually, in the history of, and I'm a huge sports TV aficionado and historian. I taught a course at Case Western Reserve on this. The first pregame show was hosted by Jack Whitaker.
Jack Whitaker, one of the greats.
One of the greats. And they basically used Gifford and Summerall with Jack. So it's just like, you know, the guys around the table. And it was Wessler who was the one who said, we got to make this an entertainment show. Yeah. I need a beautiful woman. I need a gambler, a rogue type. I need a motor mouth, and I need a football player. And together they'll be like all in the family. And it was Wessler's brilliance that did this. The first producer was a guy named Mike Pearl.
Okay.
I was the third producer, the third reiteration. Ted Shaker was the second one. And it was an unbelievable ride. It was like we're walking with superstars. When you walk through the airport with Jimmy the Greek, he was like the Pied Piper.
Wow.
People would just come swarming around him.
It would have to be kind of also like in the Howard Cosell days when he was such a gigantic figure with ABC Sports and people wanted to get close to him. So as you're producing back then, how was it week to week dealing with this? And then how exciting was it for you? Because I'm sure they kind of gave you somewhat of a carte blanche to say, okay, I want to try this, or maybe let's stretch the envelope here. Or was it formulaic, if you will, and you had to stick to one way to do it?
I would say that in respect to the show and what it was,
Yeah.
I didn't even like entertain that. It had nothing to do with formula or anything. I just wanted to be what I would bring to it. Was the reason why that Ted Shaker hired me is he said to me, he says, I need an adult in the room. Okay.
Yeah.
And I was actually, you know, for a starting in TV, I was 31, 32 years old. I had been a hospital administrator. I got into TV working the weekends.
Yeah, I got you.
And impressed a guy named Terry O'Neill, who hired me over to CBS. And then Ted saw me for a year. I produced features for him for the Super Bowl Today show.
Okay.
So my first year was learning the mechanics of the control room, which I had never really done, live TV, mirroring up the half times, not screwing that up. And since my background was research, I was a good historian even then when, you know, Brent needed a quick note or Herb needed a quick note.
Okay.
I had a great capacity, again, starting from my Jet days, of following pro football closely since 1966.
Yeah.
That I could lend, and people respected the information flow I had. So by the gravitas of giving them something they needed to make them look better.
Yeah.
The show, not to the naked eye, doesn't appear to get better, but everybody felt that it was getting to a next step.
And
so it wasn't me coming in saying, I'm going to do this. It wasn't that at all.
Yeah.
And I really never did. And I've really never done that in any of my collaborations. It doesn't work.
It doesn't. So you knew your place, and you knew it was in your head. That right in between.
It was in my head. Yeah, Jimmy. You know, and the guy that I had to correct the most was Jimmy. Jimmy was always full of false information. Just
really?
Like, oh yeah, just unbelievable. And he would get mad at me. You're making me look bad. I said, no, I'm actually trying to make you look good.
Yeah.
I said, I'm not making you look bad at all. I said. And so what I did, and this is something where you do when you're a producer, you never get stopped by a barrier. You figure out something better and go around the wall. Okay. I initiated a Saturday afternoon 2-hour meeting with Jimmy in his hotel room.
I see.
So that it wasn't the pressure of Sunday where I was trying to download this information, because I understood they're getting their makeup on. They're trying to remember what they got to say. So the education was Saturday afternoon. I would take 2 hours out, break out from the edit rooms, go spend time with Jimmy, go over his picks. And I'm not changing his picks. I'm just giving him some better notes.
See, yeah.
So he could do it the way he wanted to do it.
Well,
and, you know, and by the way, I don't have to do that with Brent Musburger, because Brent Musburger was a machine.
Yeah, he was. He was. He was tremendous.
Although it was interesting, but it interesting was, he was from Chicago, okay?
Yeah.
They really didn't like, neither Irv or him, who played in Philadelphia, as you know, the Eagles. They still were skeptical of the American Football League.
Yeah.
And that's where I had the database that they did not have, because they were dismissing the AFL.
Yeah.
Okay?
It wasn't in their head.
So
it wasn't in their head.
Yeah. So they're not going to remember the San Diego Chargers beating the Buffalo Bills when John Hadle threw 4 touchdown passes, 51-10. They're not going to remember the Buffalo Bills winning.
Yeah, they won't
AFL
know it was
title.
The rock pile they played in, right?
The
they
rock
won't even
pile.
Know that.
And the stadium that was used in the movie The Natural.
Yeah, which, they don't know that.
And again, what this job did for me as a ball boy, I'll give you an example. Loading in into Buffalo Stadium. The stairways were so narrow at Memorial Stadium that we had to go through the second floor window and rope up the cases with all the equipment and stuff. We couldn't get it up the stairs.
Oh, my God. Oh.
Yeah. So, you know, so at every turn, I'd have a story of something that was completely about, you know, that elevated the discussion beyond the AFL wasn't as good as the NFL.
Well, you know, interesting, George, because back then you're doing Jimmy the Greek stuff, and nowadays you can't go anywhere without tripping over people talking about odds and things of that nature. What are your feelings about how that's evolved?
Just like anything else in life, you know, it's the next progression. I don't engage in it. It's not my deal, betting, but I get it. To me, it's a bunch of people still who always make mistakes anyway. I mean, you know, nobody ever looks back on all the pick shows. Really, do they go back and everybody says, well, you were wrong or you were right? it's just another fun element. And look, 10 years ago, the NFL didn't let players make appearances in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
It evolves. Look what's happened. And nobody ever thought they'd have a team there. And nobody thought they'd have a hockey team there. So it's just part of the evolution. And there's no better marketed league than the National Football League. They're just a juggernaut. And that's because Roger Goodell has, you know, broken down every barrier. And his thing is, how do we make ourselves better on everything that we do all the time?
Yeah, it's just an amazing entity that we have in the sports world today, George, that it can occupy 365 days of talk.
Yeah, it does.
It really and truly does. And I just did an interview last week with Nate Ulrich. He's was the beat writer for the Akron Beacon Journal for 12 years. Now he's just doing enterprise reporting. And he said in 12 years, that was, I don't know how Mary Kay Cabot does it or Tony Grossi. Right. For all these years, it's just has to be so incredibly stressful to do that. But I guess I'm getting a little bit off the beaten path.
Why do you call it stressful?
Well, maybe it's because the team they've covered. Perhaps that's a good chunk of it. Maybe if you cover the Kansas City Chiefs in recent years, it wouldn't be as stressful. But again, there's so much time that's taken that you know you got to be on your toes 365 days out of the year.
Well, look, I think the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com is one of the best sports sections in the country. I mean. Right. You know, I was reading, I lived in New York for many years, and it's the New York Post, the New York Daily News, the Daily Mirror, and the New York Times. And they do, and Terry Pluto, if you talk about a guy, the most prolific guy in spitting out stuff, and they do a super in-depth job, no matter how bad or whatever. They're smoking out the scenarios. They use these, the new stat algorithms. And I have to tell you, I loved it when I was a kid here and went to Shaker, and I love it being back. Everybody in Cleveland is a huge, not just Browns fan, football fan.
I'm
talking about the woman who I check in with at the Brecksville Community Center, who's a huge Steeler fan and is in her 80s. And doesn't like Mike Tomlin, and it's going to let you know she doesn't like Mike Tomlin.
Got to fire Mike Tomlin.
her recall of some of his play calling is like, holy crap! I don't follow it that closely, but I just love that appreciation for that. You know, my wife went to Ohio State. She's a huge Buckeye fan, and she can give you chapter and verse. She went to Red Rite 88. You know, I met her in New York. I didn't even meet her here in Cleveland.
Wow, that was the first game I covered. That
was the first game you covered? Really?
First playoff game, George. I started in September of 80, and the first playoff game was Red Rite 88. Yep, I could see it like it was yesterday. That's crazy.
Yeah, just crazy about that. And
yeah, we're a huge football fan. Football town.
Huge. And all my friends who come, and I still stay in close touch with them, who produce and direct the game, they love coming to Cleveland.
Yeah,
you know, you couldn't say that about Cleveland 25 years ago, but Cleveland's had its own transformation in many, many ways. We've been back for 20 years, and I don't miss one day not being in New York anymore.
Wow. Well, let's move on to the Olympics, George. We can still get back to football because you were involved with the Pro Football Hall of Fame and so many things. I want to talk about your communications company, Pollock Films. There's so many things.
Thank you.
How did you tell me about the arc of the attachment to the Olympics for you? There wasn't a knee brace or Joe Willie Namath involved, but there has to be a good story.
Well, thank you for asking. But again, it wasn't Joe Willie Namath, but it's because the PR director of the Jets, Frank Ramos, reached out to me when I was had graduated from New York University. I went back to college in NYU. So Frank reached out to me, and NBC needed a spotter to be on a headset and give them every play of every game for the graphic computer. It wasn't a computer, so type in Matt Snell, 4 carries, 24 yards, 6.0 yards per carry type of thing. With his number. And then one day a stage manager got ill. So Teddy Nathanson, who was the director for NBC, got on the headset with me and said, "Have you ever stage managed?" I hadn't, but I said, "Yeah, what is it?" He said, go upstairs, and, you know, that's where you're supposed to give the announcers the cards, what commercial, or go to the commercial break. And in the booth, there is Merlin Olsen, and there is Dick Enberg.
Oh, wow.
And again, life comes around. This is like 1975. Well, Merlin Olsen was the guy who hired me at the Hall of Fame in 2009.
Wow.
And now I'm working with Merlin Olsen. So wow. I do that gig. The cameraman says to me, you're pretty comfortable in this. They're looking for a job of a researcher writer at ABC's College Scoreboard with Chris Schenkel.
Okay, another legend.
So I interviewed for that job, and I started working at ABC on Saturdays in 75, and then ended up writing for Wide World of Sports wraparounds for Cosell, for Frank Gifford on Sunday, and did a pretty good job, and they kept giving me more responsibilities. I actually wrote a documentary, The 80s in Sports, that was narrated by Gifford, McKay, and Cosell.
Wow.
And then the guy who was going to run, be the chief researcher for Lake Placid, David Downs, saw my work and said, you know, I need somebody who can organize my researchers, run the research room for me. So that was my first entree, and I went to Lake Placid, and I wrote for McKay, and I was in charge of the 8 researchers organizing the information flow to the different venues and to McKay for the telecast on behalf of David Downs. So that's how it started.
That's amazing, and we kind of walked parallel paths. I was working at a CBS station in Buffalo. Channel 4 with the great Van Miller was.
Oh, I love Van Miller. I know Van Miller.
Van the man. He was one of the most wonderful people I ever worked with. And so they sent me to Lake Placid for 2 weeks before the games. And I did 2 weeks worth of stories on just what you should expect if you venture to Lake Placid. And all I remember saying in most of my reports was, get ready to be late for everything, basically. Yes. And then I go to Lake Placid during the games. I'm covering every day. And obviously all the epic things, including the, you know, greatest upset in history and hockey and all that stuff. And there you were, you're working that thing on a network level. That's
incredible. But again, our paths, you and I know, we've been sports is a great community.
Yeah,
you're going to find a connection to anybody else you talk to, whoever was in sports. And as we're establishing now, I was there when you were there. And that's one of the great things I love about it.
Yeah. It's fantastic. So how did they get from there to all the other Olympics?
Because when I joined CBS at the network level in 1988, they wrestled away 3 Winter Olympics in a bidding war with ABC when ABC decided to get out when Cap Cities bought ABC and started selling their assets. And it was the 92 games in Little Albertville, the 94 games in Lillehammer and the Nagano.
Oh my God.
For the 3 Winter Olympics, of which I did the first 2. And the first one, I was the senior producer of every broadcast, which means I was in charge editorially to oversee that everything written, said in the air wasn't wrong or screwed up. From the morning show to the late night show. And I worked actually side by side with a news legend who was the subject of the movie Broadcast News, Susan Zirinsky, who later became the executive producer of CBS News and is like legendary in the business. And we worked side by side. So I learned a lot more from her than she learned from me, I'm sure. Yep. And I just absolutely loved it. And then in 94, I was sort of shifting myself out of the studio role. I wanted to get more live sports experience. And I did the NFL game, the number 2 game with Dick Stockton and Merlin Olsen. I produced the NBA on CBS. I started producing events. I did a lot of boxing. So I asked them at the Olympics to give me an event assignment. And I produced, I directed cross country and biathlon in 94 in Lillehammer, which was one of the first times we got 40 minutes in prime time when skiing was delayed by a snowstorm. And it was an incredible event. It was the 4x4 relay between Norway and Italy. with 100,000 Norwegians screaming as they entered
wow.
the bowl of the arena. It was unbelievable television.
Wow.
Just like
wow.
unbelievable. Excuse me. And so I had that opportunity. And then, you know, when I left CBS to open up my own production company, which I know we'll get to on the entertainment side, producing and managing Yanni, I did a lot. My company had five people. My offices were White Plains. I directed every game for ESPN's to launch in college football. I produced shows for Discovery Channel. I did, as you saw, a whole variety of different shows. I did indoor soccer. Yeah. I created a three-year deal with ESPN with the NPSL.
Yeah.
But Dick Ebersol, unbeknownst to me, admired the work that he had seen me do at the Olympics. And as a subsequent, I was hired by NBC and I produced Cross Country and Biathlon for Salt Lake in 2002 as part of my production company.
Gotcha.
And in 2004, Dick, knowing my Greek heritage, I went to Athens and produced the first ever HD telecast of the Olympics. 8 hours a day, six different sports. I thought I was done. You know, I came back to Cleveland. I was working for the Browns. And then I went back to my production company after 3 years with the Browns. And I got a phone call on the golf course in October from Molly Solomon saying, Dick wants you to produce 5.5 hours for Universal Sports, the 2010 Vancouver Games.
So that's you're back
how,
in that.
So I'm back in it. It's not because of a network. It's just because somebody saw something in me that he thought was elevated the game. And I was lucky to be Dick Ebersol, one of the legends of the game.
Let me do some of the time linking here. Did things overlap a little bit? Because didn't you also start at the Pro Football Hall of Fame kind of around that time, George?
Yeah, well, I'll give you an interesting story, which very few people at the Hall know or remember. But you have a very good chronology clock there. So I started the Hall of Fame in that same year of 2009, January. As I told you, I was a one-man paper hanger for something called Enterprise, the for-profit arm. So I was literally on my own. Okay. But I was very fortunate. I scored a big sponsorship with Van Heusen. I produced events. I created the fan vote. I was paying the Hall of Fame as well. I was paying the Hall of Fame. When I got this job, I really didn't tell anybody I got it because it was while I was working at the Hall. I never missed an email. I never missed the meeting. Nobody even knew I was
kept
gone.
Doing your thing. Yeah.
Because I was already out on the road.
Okay. Gotcha.
All the time doing events.
So you really have, you're like an NFL coach. You're like a big sports leader that you've got to compartmentalize a lot of things to be as efficient as possible, to get a lot of
correct.
Stuff done, to manage so many people. Let's go to the Hall of Fame stuff. Because while I dragged you over to that point in time, how when you got there, the chronology of where our world was back then in 2009-10, social media at that time, George, was really starting to, you know,
not really.
Did you utilize it much?
For the first 5 or 6 years.
Okay, so did you grow it? How did you grow it?
You just don't throw stuff out there to grow it. You have to have programming. It wasn't about social media. It was creating the programming.
Okay.
I created programs that were sponsorable and gave sponsors broad exposure on TV, not just social media. Social media was always the baby in the back of the bus.
Gotcha.
The beginning.
Yeah.
So
My news bosses said the same thing, George, 100% what you're saying. They said, you're trying to wag the dog with its tail and don't do that. Let's do news and let's not get so crazy over the social media because people won't come to Channel 8 if they don't like our news. It doesn't matter what we do on Twitter.
You need to have that core. Have that core. And the thing that the Hall didn't really have, it had a couple of really great programs, Heart of the Hall of Famer, which is a great one. But I created the Hometown Hall of Famer program where Hall of Famers went back to their hometown.
Got it. Okay.
To let the hometown celebrate them, which was sponsored for 10 years by Allstate and Ford. I created a two-hour TV special that announced the class. The hall just used to just do it as a press conference.
Okay.
And then we sold it to NFL Network. I created the U.S. Army Award of Excellence. The Army was having problems getting into high school to recruit, and conceived the program where we would get candidates from the school worthy of someday being in the Army. And then whoever made that cut, we would honor them at a school assembly, and then the Army could recruit at the school. And a Hall of Famer would give the award to the U.S. Army Award of Excellence winner. It was spectacular. We did 60 of those across the country. And now when you do that, you can create content from there for social media. And yes, that's how you start to grow social media. But it's still not, I mean, the Hall is not a huge institution. It's a huge brand name.
It's a huge brand. Come on.
Right.
Yeah.
But the but is, though, you're fighting the NFL. I mean, you know, you're huge in the niche of you're the only ones who have the responsibility of honoring the heroes of the game with the greatest selection process known of any institution.
Yeah.
That Joe Horgan and subsequent presidents have carefully cultivated this. It's really the most stellar selection process over a 5-month period.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, the Hall, percentage-wise, is a very small number of Hall of Famers compared to the other Hall of Fames related to the total number of players that played in the game.
I get it's, you.
I mean, they cap it at 8 or 9, and it's very prestigious. And but, you know, there are how many millions play the game? How many? And you're still at less than 400 in the Hall. So that we leveraged a lot. And then I did work with David Baker and produced and created The Knock on the Door. That was
I love that. I love that.
That was a superstar property that today is, it was great for social media. We partnered with Bleacher Report to help us, because Bleacher Report could tag the Hall of Fame and get us more traffic than if we put it on the Hall of Fame. You got to partner a lot in social media when you're growing up the ladder.
Yeah.
And now they have a deal with NFL Network for a 1-hour special.
Yeah, that I'll tell you, the Knock on the Door thing, anything stick out to you? I mean, first of all, David Baker is just a mammoth man, and with that huge smile, and how he used to say on behalf of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, it always gives me a little bit of chills there. What was that like? I mean, these are grown men bawling their eyes out, crying, so emotional. The reactions are just so humane and so downright emotional. It's fun to watch. What was it like being a part of that and going around with David doing that stuff?
Honored, special, magical, everything that you just said, because that honor changes a person's life. And you think for all the money and prestige they've had, the Randy Mosses, especially the modern day players who have been fortunate to make enough to be comfortable in their lives. But if you don't, life doesn't have a purpose. If you don't have something else that becomes your passion, you can't sustain just on money alone. It doesn't work. And when they get that gold jacket, they are now symbolic of hope and inspiration for so many people. It's uplifting that they're sought out for their wisdom, and it makes them feel so relevant to what is going on. And it's their family's legacy. It's their legacy forever and ever. To have that, and not many people get to say that about something that they do. Because when you die, you die, you're done.
Yeah.
But when you're in the Hall of Fame, you're a Hall of Famer forever. You don't die. You're
always
going to be talked about. You're always going to be seen with the bust. I can see that. You can see that and feel that. And it was special to think that you were able to create something that really captured the moment and made it for them one of the most special things in their lives.
No, it's a brilliant idea on your part, and
well,
beautifully
I'm part of
executed.
A team. Well, part of a team, part of a team. But you know, it was a confluence of having the right guy to do the knock and David Baker.
Yeah.
The right partners who were willing to take the risk And all the also the players too, because keeping the secret is not easy.
No, it is not. I did that on a very small level. Bobby DiBiase and myself surprised Josh Cribbs this past year when he was part of the Greater Cleveland Sports Hall of Fame class. And we went on his TV show with his wife on some other pretense, and we dropped the bomb on him. And I want to tell you, he was like, me? You know, I mean, he was so emotional. And it
wasn't
was like,
amazing.
This is the Greater Cleveland Sports Hall of Fame. This is in Canton. And it was such a special feeling.
That,
and you get to be a part. They got that, to be a that, part of that. That's so
that,
cool.
That means a lot. But the one thing that was very special for me personally was when I went back to my old show, the NFL okay. Today, to surprise Bill Cowher.
Oh,
and
yes.
So when I walked in to survey, and the cameraman came over to me, and the people in the control room that I had worked with that were still there came over to me. And then to have that moment, and when Sean McManus, who president of CBS Sports, father Jim McKay, and Sean was a production assistant when I was a writer at ABC. That's how long I've known him. And to be able to do this with him, because this whole thing, we came up with this whole plan within 2 days of the election. No paperwork, complete personal relationship with Eric Shanks of Fox, Sean McManus of CBS. That was really super special. As I said to somebody, so I have done my my last and best show ever here in the NFL Today, thanks to Knock on the Door.
Wow. I'm telling you, absolutely spectacular. I just love it. Man, let's move along here as we can.
Sure.
There's been so many things to talk about, George. New Jersey Hall of Fame, that's a more recent endeavor that you've been involved in. And we're talking New Jersey. We're talking Springsteen. We're talking some of the greatest stars in the world. What has that been like to be involved in producing that?
I'll tell you, it was one of the things that I wanted to do with my company was to be that sort of museum whisperer for a number of these institutions. I've loved being part of the history of the Hall of Fame. I actually have to thank, you're not going to believe this, because a lot of people in this town didn't like him when he was president of the Browns, but it was John Collins.
Okay, yeah,
Collins brought me to Cleveland. If it hadn't been for John Collins, I would not have worked for the Browns. None of this would have happened.
Yeah, he was with the Randy Lerner ownership.
Well, that's where I was when Romeo got hired as a coach and Savage.
Yep.
But John, who I've always stayed in touch with, is been a great mentor for me. And today, by the way, people will know he's like minority owner of the Long Island, of the Islanders in Long Island.
Because
he worked at the NHL for a long time. So John said, I want you to meet a guy. My brother-in-law works with this guy in the commercial real estate business. He's president of the New Jersey Hall of Fame. I think the two of you guys are going to get along great. But his name is Steve Edwards, and he is a force, like Baker was a force. And the thing I love about the New Jersey Hall of Fame is that you can, and it's probably pretty instructive maybe for what you do with the Cleveland Sports Hall of Fame, a little bit different.
Okay.
You can be from any field and get in. It's only one or two Hall of Fames where it's not specific to a field.
I see
like
what you
mean. The Sports Hall of Fame or the Arts Hall of Fame or the Music Rock and Roll.
Okay.
And so all of a sudden, you're having, Thomas Edison is in the New Jersey Hall of Fame. Okay. He's next to David Chase, who created the Sopranos. The
Sopranos created.
Okay.
Wow.
Who's next to Gloria Gaynor? Who's next to Tony Orlando?
This is awesome.
It was an eclectic show. I had the chance, Danny DeVito was the host. Was just a riot, just an absolute riot. There was only one sports inductee. It was two, I should say. It was Tiki Barber.
Okay.
And it was Sue Weston, who played at Rutgers and was the first gay athlete in the WNBA. Some other businessmen you wouldn't know who are fascinating people. And I just love the passion that Steve Edwards has for the history of New Jersey. And this is what makes this guy so special. I produced the 15th induction. They never had a building.
Really? Now do they do?
Or? Yes. They're building it. They've gotten their money from the state. And that's a lesson to know for you, because, you know, you might, you, how many of what induction is this for the Cleveland Sports Hall of Fame? What number?
It's up in the upper 30s to 40. 30s. It's been quite a few years.
Yeah. But, you know, they were able to convince the state to give them, you know, funds to create this incredible 12,000 foot, they call it the Educational Learning Center. Not a museum, and it's in the Great American Mall, which is the mall. It's not the Mall of America, but it's a huge mall in East Rutherford where you've got this space. But it was a special show to do because you had music performances as well. And by the way, the speeches.
Oh my God.
It wasn't like the Pro Football Hall of Fame. the longest speech was like 5 minutes.
Okay.
It made for a great show.
Oh,
so I was
gosh.
Very honored to be part of it. I'm part of it again this year. I'm working with Steve and the executive committee on helping them and producing, getting rights fees to the different videos. They have an incredible, if you go through Newark Airport, you're going to see branding for the New Jersey Hall of Fame like you wouldn't believe. If you drive up 95, you can go to the Whitney Houston Plaza. They're smart marketers. You know, we didn't do that at the Pro Football Hall of Fame. If you're trying to rename, you know, I-80 plazas, and it's pretty cool. So
yeah,
it's a pleasure. Awesome. It's a pleasure to have work with them, and I have to thank John Collins. And again, if I wasn't here in Cleveland with Collins, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's so great to hear that, the story about how that's come about. And no spoilers here, but we're in the early stages of hopefully someday having bricks and mortar as well. So
I agree. If I can help you guys, as I said to Mark Termini, I'm here to help. I've seen the model and how it can work and how you can make things so that what you do gets out there, because Cleveland has a great sports tradition.
It really
it's
does.
It's worthy of having a building or a wing or something.
The New Jersey, like here in Cleveland, our Hall of Fame is predicated on, you know, you were a great athlete that played in Cleveland or you're from here. But that's what sets ours apart from a little bit from other ones. It's like my example of what makes the Greater Cleveland Sports Hall of Fame what it is Jim Brown is not in our Hall of Fame, even though he was the GOAT. But he wasn't from here, nor did he make this his home after he, you know, was
you have your rules. Yeah. I get it.
And yet Bob Feller is in our Hall of Fame because Bob Feller lived in Gates Mills all those years post retirement. And but in New Jersey,
the requirement is like your requirement. You have had to live in New Jersey at least 5 years.
I got you. Okay. All right. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. But most of the people that could get in, I can tell you, have been lifelong New Jerseyans.
Okay.
I mean, like Meryl Streep's not in yet, but she spent 5 years in New Jersey as part of her journey.
So she qualifies.
She qualifies. Right, exactly.
Okay. George, you have been really involved a lot in things pertaining to Greek heritage. Let's speak to that a little bit. Give me impetus there.
Well, thank you. The impetus was my incredible parents and family.
Sure.
All my grandfathers came through Ellis Island.
Yeah.
They worked in the 1900s, 1910s. They loved America. My one grandfather ran an ice cream company in Queens called Bungalow Bar. My other grandfather lives in Forest Hills.
Cool.
My dad and mother met at a Greek resort hotel in the Catskill Mountains. They thought they'd stay in New York their whole life. My dad, who was an All-American soccer player at MIT, World War II veteran, Greatest Generation Bronze Star, fought with Patton. Incredible gentleman. Looked like Arnold Palmer, loved golf, loved America, gets a job at Ford in Detroit. And, you know, my mother's like, Detroit, what the hell is that? You know, she's living in New York. There are a lot of Greeks there. But again, the lovely Greek community of St. Constantine and Helens in Detroit, Greek town in Detroit.
Yeah.
We moved to Ann Arbor, another Greek church. So my whole life was living that, my big fat Greek wedding. That was my life. And I ended up marketing that movie
I was just going to get to that.
and I produced three documentaries for public television, talking about all these other Greeks who have the same story as I've had across the country. They're an incredible group. I've been blessed. I speak the language. My wife is Greek American. My in-laws here, and my mother-in-law is still with us and lives here in Brecksville, Catherine Gallus.
That's beautiful.
You know, we're very, very, very blessed to have that culture. And my 32-year-old son, who works at PNC, is taking Greek lessons at church.
Oh, that's beautiful. That is.
And by the way, Cleveland is an ethnic community, which when I was here in the 60s, Alex and I go to the Ukrainian festival. The ethnicity in this town is another hidden gem.
It sure is, Jordan.
It's a hidden gem. Yeah. Coptic churches, Baptist churches.
Yep.
It's
Russian
really,
Orthodox.
Yeah. And that was the experience I had living in Shaker. You know, mm-hmm. Shaker was all of that. And I'm still very close to my teammates and my classmates there of different ethnicities. So anyway, okay. That's my Greek story, and I'm sticking to it.
And it's a great story, and keep sticking to it. It's great. So, Gallus, is that isn't the Brecksville gymnastics family Gallus, or am I getting the wrong?
No, it's the wrong. You know, they're a different family. My father-in-law was a federal judge magistrate in town. James, he was on the planning board, the zoning board.
Okay.
And my wife has served three terms here as city council person.
Okay,
upon
your wife,
our return, Kimberly.
Wife,
yeah.
Kim. Yep, Kimberly. Okay. It's somewhere in your resume, it mentioned 30 for 30.
Yeah.
What connection to that? Did you produce some episodes, or did you oversee production of some, or how did that
I
work
brought,
for you,
no,
George?
You know, as you know, Jimmy the Greek was fired under my watch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I felt badly for him. He got obliterated. He just wasn't fired. He was obliterated.
He did. Yeah.
So I wanted to do something to bring him back to life. It took me 5 years to convince his family to let me use them in a pitch for a 30 for 30 documentary on Jimmy the Greek.
And then
it took me another 3 years, thanks to the help of John Walsh, the executive editor of ESPN, who was my researcher at the NFL Today and knew Jimmy, to convince ESPN that doing a documentary on Jimmy the Greek wouldn't wreck havoc on them. And so I produced and Fritz Mitchell directed The Legend of Jimmy the Greek, which was a Sports Emmy finalist, and nobody thought it would be like anything like that. Fritz did a great job, and we were able to tell Jimmy's life. We did this segment, of course, what he did in Washington, which was wrong.
Yeah.
But it wasn't everything of what his life was. As a matter of fact, for the record, on that Saturday after the incident happened Friday, it was Martin Luther King weekend in Washington. We were there for the Commanders playoff game in 1989. Jesse Jackson and Roy Innes of CORE and
he was with the not the Brotherhood, but I know.
Yeah,
Economic Opportunity.
Push or something like that.
Yeah.
He was out of Chicago, not to mention he ran for president. They held a joint press conference with Jimmy saying he wasn't a racist.
Yeah.
But the problem was that 6 months earlier, Al Campanis had when questioned by Ted Koppel, said he didn't think blacks would be qualified to baseball manage in the mood in the country. And Jimmy was getting older and crankier,
yep,
and a whole bunch of these factors. So I was happy to do that. And that's the 30 for 30 I produced.
I see. Okay. So you kind of wanted to set the record
straight. I conceived
it
and produced it. Yep.
Yep. I understand. Okay. And of course, today, getting back to social media that I asked you about earlier, today with so much of it, I mean, you know, Jimmy's was a hot point and then basically canceled way back when, done, kaput. Nowadays, those cycles go in a day and then we're off to the next thing to get upset about.
Yep. Yeah. Just the way it is, the way it is. You know, it's not always going to be what you'd like it to be. Nobody's going to take the time to reflect, It's a different way of putting together history these days. It can be overwhelming, but I actually find if you manage it and manage yourself with it, you can get a lot of, it's a great informational tool. But if you sift through everything, don't take it all on the surface. Don't try to get everything. Don't worry about if you don't get everything, because in the end, nobody cares. But I still love what the internet can be, if you use it properly within context.
I get you. Yeah, I totally agree with that. Well, you know, let's move on to some of the folks that you've been known, have been friends with and have known in the business. Jim Nance lives part of the year here. I think Jim is just absolutely one of the top shelf announcers of any era.
I agree.
Much less this one.
Well, you would know better than I would, but he was tremendous.
And I feel like a kindred spirit to Jim in the sense that we're kind of the same age-ish. I'm a little older. But, we came up in the way the media was in that era. When you were a sportscaster, I think he was in Salt Lake, you were on just one of three stations, and you only had one of a few select jobs. Yep. Nowadays, there's a bazillion different jobs, and it was appointment viewing when you were on the air versus nowadays. What's the relationship with him for you?
Very close. Very close. I just talked to him a couple of weeks ago. He's a dear friend. When I did produce the Cotton Bowl Parade, we went to see JFK together, Oliver Stone's movie, with his first wife in a theater to see what the reaction was like in Dallas. I text him messages during the game of things that might be helpful notes to him. He accepts them, which is unbelievable. He could be a senator. He could have been anything else, but his love and passion and professionalism around sports and around broadcasting is legendary. Just a terrific person, terrific friend.
Yeah, George, he really, truly is phenomenal. And last night was the latest example of how he called that game. It was a fantastic game right down to the
end. Wide right again.
Wide right again. I mean, what a call. And he said it, and we had everything at that game, complete with a most likely retired pro football player jumping out of a loge with his chest, with his shirt off, holding a beer. I mean, is there anything the NFL can't give us? It's just amazing, George.
Well, I don't think the NFL had anything to do with that.
I know.
Just happened to be that was. But you're
talking about Jason Kelsey.
Yeah, I know. I get it. It's really unbelievable. It's really unbelievable. But that's what it is today. It's entertainment.
Yeah, it really is. It's consumed by so many people. It's just an amazing
football is. I was talking to somebody today. You said it, I think earlier, the when you're talking about the Cleveland sports writers. Yeah. We should be lucky. The people actually give a damn that much about football that we can do it 365 days a year. How wonderful is it that we can do that and use that as a common communicative tool?
Yeah.
And it gives people pleasure. Let me tell you, I think people dread more when the Super Bowl is over, the weather in Cleveland, than when Christmas is over. Because at least when Christmas is over, you still got all the playoff games you can see. But when that Super Bowl is over, you got to struggle to get to the opening game of the Guardians season, or get to the Cavaliers when a game actually means something.
Exactly. There is that window. You're absolutely right. Early February to like April, when at least the baseball team's starting to play, and that if the Cavs are in the playoffs, that the playoffs are going to start. And we've had some great runs here in town. Sure wish there were more championships. I don't know. Were you at the 64 championship game?
Yes.
I was as well. My gosh, this is fantastic.
Yeah, and I produced the show for the Browns. That's how I got to Cleveland. I produced the 40th anniversary show at Severance Hall.
Okay.
I created that show with Bill Applegate at the head of WOIO at the time. I had Casey Coleman interview the team members. I had Roy Firestone, and the co-host was Steve Sable. The Browns Championship Trophy, which is in Berea, I designed and had it unveiled there by Paul Pagliabue, and that got me my job at the Browns. And I had the music of the Cleveland Pops Orchestra playing
what
the music
of
NFL films to kick off the season. By the way, that was a John Collins idea. And the Browns, people forget, in that season, 2004, they started out 3-0.
Oh, yeah.
And if you remember, It's only when the Eagles beat him with Terrell Owens throwing the ball in the dog pound through a banner, and we lost that overtime game 3-4, and then the wheels fell off, and Butch Davis said he couldn't take it anymore.
Oh, yeah, he kind of had a meltdown there in Cincinnati, if I recall.
Yep, boy, sure
boy, you're about to tell you, George, you're throwing some names. Bill Applegate, when I was in Buffalo, he was the news director at the opposing station, and then he went to San Francisco, and he almost hired me. Real quickly, almost hired me to be their weekend sportscaster in San Francisco, except he didn't hire me. He hired a guy from Cleveland who had more experience than me, Fred McLeod.
Oh, yeah.
And
who
I,
went to end up
and
in
the got And I got Fred McLeod's job at Channel 8. I told you, George, this is the smallest business in the world.
Hey, listen, I got a 4 o'clock call. Anything else I can help you with or ask you?
No, you're fantastic. I appreciate much that you would want to reminisce a little bit about your career. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I look forward to posting this, and best wishes to you as we move forward.
Well, thank you, and I'll give you my one last note because we didn't touch him, but another, the unbelievable story about how I got involved with Yanni. It's because I started using his music in sports creatives, and John Tesh tied me up, and I produced his first concert in Dallas with an orchestra in 1990, and we conceived Live at the Acropolis together, and 4 years later, produced it, and that's why I left CBS and took him around the world and had the pleasure of producing the show at the Taj Mahal in the Forbidden City in China.
Wow, that's wild. Well, I'll tell you what, George, we could talk for hours. Thanks very much. Look forward to talking to you soon.
Thanks, John. Bye-bye. Take care.
You too.
Thanks very much, George, for a great conversation, and thank you for listening. As always, please rate, subscribe, hit that follow button. If you get a chance, share this episode, spread the word, and let folks know about the conversations we have here on Telich Talks. Always fun delving into the past of some very interesting people and accomplished folks like George Veras, right here on Telich Talks. Thanks again. We'll see you guys next week for another edition of Telich Talks.